Hey, it's Arvid, and you're listening to The Bootstrap Founder. Today, I'm talking to Ben Romich, the founder of Flagsmith, a bootstrapped SaaS business in the feature flag space. From open source software to on-premise deployments, we will dive into building a single-purpose tool for a wide variety of customers and how to scale a bootstrap business along the way. This episode is sponsored by Paddle.com, also a tool that will help you scale your bootstrap business because they'll handle all things payment related so you can focus on growing your own product and focus all your attention there where it belongs. I use Paddle for all my projects and you really should also check them out. Now, let's talk feature flags. Here's Ben. You have bootstrapped Flagsmith, which is really cool. It's a software built around feature flag management, which is very interesting, and controlled software releases, which is something that I have no control over in my own businesses, just saying. But tell me more about that. What is Flagsmith?
Yeah, so Flagsmith, well, it's a number of things. As a sort of entity, it's a commercial open source sort of project and business. It's a software tool and technique that allows products and engineering teams to, control who sees features, when they see them, how features behave, and basically the principal concept is it allows you to decouple the action of deploying your software with the event of releasing features. You decouple those two things, and normally, and up until 10 years ago, there was they were intrinsically linked. When you wanted to release a feature, you did a build, right? Like that's kind of like what you did. And then, I don't know how long it's getting on now, maybe 12 years ago, there was a couple of papers, one by Martin Fowler, a blog even, like one by the photo sharing site Flickr. And they were like, this is how we're releasing features. And I remember the Flickr one, everyone was like, wow, that's crazy. Like that sounds really dangerous and prone to problems and all this sort of stuff. And over time, the segment has really matured. There's like a bunch of providers out there of all different shapes and sizes, which we're one in a quadrant. And like as an engineering concept, it's become, I wouldn't say it's like, I don't know, like this is a question we often wonder is like, what percentage of engineering teams in the world are using feature flags, right? And we think it's quite low. It's still not, the accepted wisdom of how you deliver, develop and deploy modern software. But it's definitely getting there. And a lot of the business and a lot of the open source projects is about like discussing those engineering techniques and educating people about what the pros and cons are. Because engineers always love to talk about the technology and the sort of the software. But it's actually much more about the engineering and the process, the people, and the kind of stuff that doesn't have ones and noughts associated to it. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's the problem, right? Maybe it's the fact that it's not just code, right? It takes a slightly different mindset for an engineer to adopt the idea that not everything has to do with like entering a Git push command or something, right? To deploy. It's interesting to see because I've seen in my forays into software engineering, which I've been doing for a couple decades now, that with the frameworks in particular, and I use Laravel in the PHP world right now, it is becoming almost a first class citizen now that these things are now part of the big packages, or at least they think about it, right? It's a little bit of it.
Yeah, whereas you think like 10 years ago or 5 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. Actually, there is a plug I want to give. So there's a project called Open Feature, which is a CNCF project. So I'm on the governance board of that. It's kind of progressing through the CNCF sausage factory at the moment. And it's trying to define and implement an open standard for feature flags. And the reason I mentioned it, well, I should mention it anyway, because I'm on the board for it and we believe in it. But where you get a framework like Laravel or Rails or Django or whatever, there's discussions with some of those folk around putting open feature stuff into Laravel. And so the idea would be that you could create a Flagsmith account or an account with another provider and define your flags. And then you wouldn't have to do any dependency stuff in Laravel or whatever. You could just say, right, I want to use Flagsmith as my provider. Here's my API key. And you don't have to muck around with anything. So that's definitely like as a sort of a signal of where the kind of the concept is in terms of its maturity within the industry. That's where it's at. And so, yeah, like that's been something that we've been working on since its inception. It was an idea brought up by Dynatrace, who have to give a shout out. They've been really, really good, providing engineering time, resource and pushing the project. And it's now going through the CNCF process. It's definitely something that I think most of, or if not all of the providers are kind of like on board with. If for those that are aware of OpenTelemetry, it's very analogous to OpenTelemetry, but feature flagging, yeah.
That's really cool. I love this. Like, I was already amazed that it was a commercial open source project, but now also seeing you push for open standards, like that is awesome. I work in podcasting with my own thing, right? I aggregate and transcribe podcasts, and there's a lot of open standard work there too, which even just makes it possible to work with the whole ecosystem. So it is really cool to see you push for that and still include everybody else. I think that is just such a quite inclusive way of approaching the thing.
I think that open standards have kind of, I remember like 15 years ago, there was maybe 20 years ago, it was much more common for they're kind of a little bit of a curiosity now, you know. I think especially with like JSON and stuff, like all these kind of schemaless or kind of like, you know, sort of in a way schemaless things, I'm old enough to remember Corba and XML, deep XML stuff, and you know, all these like crazy, you know, enterprise Java bees, all that sort of stuff. So definitely believe that's the wrong way to go. And JSON's kind of like broken us free of that, and REST has broken us free of that. But the concept of there being like like common standards is kind of it feels like it's more and more unusual to come across, yeah.
I mean, barely any big player has any vested interest in these standards, right? Maybe for interoperability, maybe for being able to have some kind of API integration, but that's where it ends. Like, their internal data representation is their own thing. Their API thing is their own thing. If you look at the Stripe API as well as it is designed, hey, everything is kind of custom. Everything is very arbitrary and opinionated. So, yeah, it's just REST, right? It's just JSON data, but everything else about the data, the connections between stuff, that is their own design, which is fine, but it's not very open, right? It's well documented, but not open.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine like Stripe and Adyen and a bunch of others getting together?
Wouldn't that be awesome? Maybe
agreeing like a common, it's not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, no, it probably isn't, if it were, it would make it so much easier to build integrations for these things. And I mean, that is probably, yeah, if you want vendor lock-in as a big business, like it doesn't really make much sense to offer this or even make it feasible. It's still great that you chose the open source approach here. And I always feel when I see businesses built on open source that the founder or the founding team, they must be very masochistic about this. Like, they must really love pain, because whoever I talk to, there's always dealing with people in the open source world. And I don't mean like people who are really engaged and really enthusiastic. They're great. But dealing with people who are needy and entitled, that seems to be a common threat. Have you encountered this as well?
To be honest, not that much. I mean, a bit. But in the grand scheme of things, like, and we definitely get way more... thank yous or how can I contribute or whatever, rather than like, you know, I demand you. I mean, we do get some, like, you know, and it's not so much on the kind of GitHub side of the fence. It's much more on the, you know, I don't know, our chat support on our website. People are like, right, I've got this thing running. It's the open source version and I need you to basically spend an hour helping me configure it and getting like these error messages fixed up. And we're like, you know, we'll help you a little bit, but like, I'm not going to spend like, you know, more than 5 minutes doing this, because You know, you're not paying for my time. That happens occasionally, but not that often. And I mean, even then, like, you know, if you were squinting, you could see, oh, you know, maybe, you know, they sort of like bumped their head on this bit of the platform because we don't have the documentation for that. And so then you go and you go, yeah, fair enough. That's not clear in the documentation, or it's not even mentioned or whatever. You know, like, right, yeah, if you're using Laravel and it's on blah, then you might have this blah, and, or, you know, or fix it. So I always kind of think, oh, okay, you know, because one of the huge sort of prizes that we really, really try and achieve is you should be able to get the platform up and running really, really quickly and easily and in a production state that can deal with production workloads. And you should be able to integrate it into your application without, you know, bumping your head or having to message us. And a lot of the architecture and infrastructure design around the platform speaks to that. So we have like one data store, which is Postgres, and we have one monolith application, API, front end, or everything. And that's it. Like there's nothing else. There's no Redis. There's no Elasticsearch. There's no yada, yada, yada. Like
no Kubernetes, like no nice complicated deployment system.
We've got Helm charts, but it's literally start Postgres, run this API, and that's it. So, it depends on the project, but you see some projects where, I mean, like Sentry is the classic example. It's like, you know, 27 services, which is fine. Like they probably need 27 services. We don't. There's been a number of times where, you know, we've been at that crossroads and it's like, do we use Redis or do we use, do you know, let's introduce X service. And then we've gone like, the task processor was a really good one. Like would really been a lot easier with Redis as the broker. And we were like, no, you know, our customers, the last thing they want is another data store in their stack. Like that's like the number one thing that they hate. And so we've always steered the boat in that direction. Yeah.
I guess Postgres is a good choice for all of this, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I actually saw a good post the other day on like all the things you can do with it.
Yeah. Vector storage, like GIS, right?
Yeah, I didn't even know. It's got like a cron scheduler. You can use it as, you know, like it's crazy yet.
Yeah, it's funny because those are the tools they tell us not to build, right? The everything tools. But then again, for a database, it just feels like you just need to make it flexible enough at the core and give it all these little extra things. And all of a sudden, it becomes your scheduler. It becomes your key value store and your transactional database, which is nice.
Yeah, but definitely, we're really happy with that. That we feel that decision's really, really paid off. The other really interesting thing about that is like once you've introduced a new service, you're not taking that out of your stack, right? Like that's just not going to happen. Like realistically,
yeah. And you add more things to use the service to make it useful, right? It becomes a psychological game where then we could totally put this new feature on there. I love the simplicity of this. And I do wonder, because like in most software businesses, like when people start a business and they try to find their first customers, usually it's a SaaS approach, right? They build it on their own system. And then they get into on-premise and then they get into, you know, like private cloud or whatever, like other ways of deploying these things is feasible or makes sense to them. And then they start to build these packages that they can easily deliver and easily deploy without causing too much fuzz. What was your story there? Did you start out with all three? Because you have all three.
No. So we originally started the project. It was just an open source thing. Like I've been running a software agency in London for like 18 years at this point. And we always used to come up with different crazy things to do in our spare time. And none of them could have been legitimate businesses by their own right. There were always crazy ideas. Like my favorite one was we had an Instagram clone called Life is Terrible. And you had to take photos of it when your life had gone wrong. And the filters made the photos look worse.
Okay. I don't want to be insulting, but that sounds like a very British thing to do.
No one in America would have used that.
No, probably not. That's funny.
Yeah, so we'd always come up with stupid ideas, and then we decided to be more rigorous around what sort of things we built in our spare time. And so we wanted to use feature flagging for our clients, for the agency. And at the time, we went to GitHub to look for, because we'd seen that Launch Darkly was getting on its ascendancy. That's the kind of big player in the space. And we didn't want to kind of pay. It was quite expensive. We felt it was quite expensive. People think that it's trivial serving flags. And it is quite simple. You know, it's not very transactional, et cetera, but it isn't trivial, especially when you're serving them at scale. And so we were like, okay, what's on GitHub? There wasn't really anything on GitHub. There was a couple of like little projects that were like, they were either language specific or framework specific. And we were like, look, this is obvious. Like there was, you know, at the time there was like, it was very common that you get, you know, a commercial venture-backed company that would push the space or create the segment. And then you'd see like open source companies or commercial open source projects sort of like filling in that gap. And there wasn't one feature flagging. So we were like, okay, that's a nice opportunity. We're really the perfect people to build it because we'd be our own customers. We know exactly how we want the API to feel, what the SDKs would look like and all this sort of stuff. And also it's a great project that you can build an MVP. I think we had an MVP out in like a week where, like an internal one where it's like, you know, it had an admin interface and you could add flags and you could toggle flag values. And it had I think the JavaScript SDK was the first one that we built. And, you know, that could connect to the API and do all that. So it was a great project to start with, but we really did it for ourselves. And we put it on GitHub. After we spent ages worrying that there was going to be a API key in this source code history that we'd forgotten about. But I think there's good tools for that now. And then at first, like we just sort of thought, we didn't really, well at all, analyze or research the market. So my experience was that, you know, you do that, you do a SaaS platform, away you go, you know, and then step four is profit. And we did it. We did that. We built out. You know, we started hosting it properly. You know, in a fault tolerant manner on AWS, and we put a website together. And at the time, it was called Bullet Train, which is a terrible. Never name your projects. If someone Googles you, you shouldn't be competing with things like actual trains. So definitely, that's something that we discovered. So it was called Bullet Train. I kind of like the name, but for a commercial business, it's not a good idea. And we got a bit of, we didn't market it really. We weren't like, right, you know, we need to get 5,000 GitHub stars in a month or a year or anything like that. We were just kind of doing it for ourselves. And the SaaS business wasn't picking up at all. We didn't really care because we were running the agency. We were working on it in our spare time. That's one of the big learnings for us was having a kind of, well, depends where you are in the world, consulting business, software agency, getting paid for your time. When you're an agency and you don't have any paid work, that's kind of an existential crisis situation because you're like, that person is burning up money because they're not billing. But actually what the big discovery for me was that that's an opportunity that is free for you as a business, because that person's salary has already been paid. They're really, you know, they're an engineer, you know, everything about them, you know, what they're good at, you know, their strengths and weaknesses, you know, what they can work on and what they can't. You're in an office with, you know, like that's an amazingly valuable opportunity. If you've got like, you know, so we would be like, oh God, you know, like we've got one front end developer and one back end developer and one design and not billing. And now I'd be like, that's absolutely brilliant because that's the team. They can go and build something, right? And it's free because you've already sunk that cost. I mean, the rest of the money, the rest of the agency needs to be making money, otherwise you go bust. But that's going to happen anyway, right? Like, whether you've built a side project or not, you're still going to go bust. So that was a hugely valuable thing. So we kind of didn't really care too much. Probably, we probably should have cared a bit more, and things would have started or would have grown a little bit faster. But, you know, we weren't, you know, I don't really have regrets about that. But then what happened was, yeah, what you're saying about people running on-prem, we started getting contacted from massive companies and saying, you know, I really like this platform. And that's one of the other benefits of open source, right? They can just, well, now, like, you know, Docker pull, Docker compose up, get it running on their local machine and play around with it and say, right, okay, so I've got this running on my machine. I could see how this is now going to be running. I can see the path to that running in our data center and us using that, because I'm not allowed, I'll get sacked if I use the SaaS product. That's another interesting unknown percentage, which is, you know, what percentage of companies, that large companies out there, have that like predication of, you can't put this sort of data outside of our control. Yeah, that's a different discussion.
That's probably quite sizable, right? It's probably a lot of these businesses that have this.
I think it's more than people, I think it's more than engineers think, is my answer. I think engineers would underestimate what that number is. But it also depends on what the type of product is as well. Like, we're potentially dealing with data, like, per, you know, you can send what we call trait data about your users or the thing that's running the application, and then control what flag values are received based on those traits. So you can say, you know, if they're on an iPhone, then turn this feature on, or if they're in Canada, then they should not be able to, you know, I don't know, buy guns or whatever.
But yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Those companies then want to be able to run all that stuff on premise, and they started asking us, how do we, you know, how much is it? And that was when we were really in trouble, because at that point I was like, I have absolutely no idea. Like, how much do I charge for this? And at the time we were charging, remember we got the first like inbound lead, and it was kind of like, they were really like sort of almost aggressively wanting to buy the software. Like, we really need it. How much is it? And at the time, I think our most expensive SaaS plan was like £100 a month. And so I kind of got anxious, and I was just like, I just shot out a number and I said, oh, it'd be £400 a month. And so for those listening who don't have the same amount of experience as I did at the time about enterprise sales, no one pays £400 a month for anything, right? Like, it's not, they would be like, these guys aren't serious. They don't know what they're doing, which was true. That was an accurate analysis of the situation from my point of view. We started to get more of an uptick. And at that point, we realized that we needed to get some other people to join the team who had experience of speaking to those people. You know, at the time, I didn't even know, it's called go-to-market, right? I didn't even know what that, I was like, what is that? Enterprise sales, go-to-market motion, you know, get all of your pricing organized, all of your, you know, your legals support, all of that sort of stuff. Yet, it's kind of dull. If you're an engineer, it's, you know, it's not writing code, it's not pushing commits or anything like that. But in our case, that was the business pretty much. Like, it's like, maybe, I think now, it's not all the business. I think our SaaS, non-SaaS revenue is about 25%, 75%. So, you know, it's a lot. And they're, you know, that servicing those two types of customer are very different. And, you know, the economics of serving those two types of customers is very different, but the business wouldn't be, and the project wouldn't be where it is today if we hadn't have made a sort of like an admission to ourselves that, like, we don't know what we're doing at this point with regards to this aspect of the business. We don't know how big it is either. And it turns out that, you know, there's a huge addressable market for people who want to run on-premise feature flags. In our case, So we went out and we found not a venture capital company. We didn't do that, but we did find three guys who had formed a business recently before we did that deal called Polychrome Capital. And they came on and we kind of did an equity swap. So they worked on the business to get it like 20 times the MRR that it was at the time. And for that, we gave them half the organization, half the business, which, you know, I remember telling my brother, I was thinking about doing this deal and he got really angry. He was like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why would you give them half the business? And I was like, look, this could be the enterprise part of the company, could be the majority of it, right? And without those folk, we're not going to, you know, we could be selling stuff 8 times cheaper than we could be. And so I've said before to other people, it's like easily the best deal I've made in my career in terms of making that admission and realizing the moment where, if you love something, set it free kind of thing. It was very much that moment of like, this is time for me to, right, and the team to say to ourselves for it to get to the next stage and to grow to the next point. We need other people involved and other areas of expertise that weren't just engineers or hackers, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of founders have this fear of that moment because they know they have to give something up, right? Not just like that they have to give up being the technical founder and knowing everything about the business, which is probably more what it is than the technical part, but giving up agency, giving up like just being able to do whatever you want on a whim with your business. Do you sometimes regret this? Because you took that choice and you made it and you got out better on the other side. Is there still regret?
Well, the interesting thing is that didn't actually happen. I feel like if anything, I was sort of freed up more. And the reason for that is that, first of all, I didn't have to deal with selling all this, doing all this stuff that I wasn't qualified to do. They did all that, right? Like, or they knew people who could come on board and help, like, you know, I don't know, accountants or lawyers or people like that. People who could build, you know, CRM systems and get all that up and running and build that engine. I didn't have to do any of that anymore, right? Which was great. And then the other thing is, it wasn't a VC thing. So it wasn't like, right, you know, we're basically going to give you a bunch of money, but you're basically going to give us control of the board and add decision on strategic direction is final and, you know, blah, 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 blah. We was part of the deal. It was like, they have final say. So Polychrome have final say on matters of commercial, you know, I don't know, pricing, or if we say no to a customer, or things of that nature. And then technical stuff and product, we were going to maintain control of that because, you know, like decisions around what was put in the open source repositories and what was proprietary, all of that stuff. So, I mean, you know, in a way, pragmatically, all right, you know, not legally, but in terms of like pragmatically, the originating team's sort of day-to-day lives, we were freed up way more on account of that. I'm conscious of there's an analogy around Brexit. So for those of you, I mean, I'm still very angry about it, but you know, a lot of people in, you know, when the UK voted to leave the European Union, a lot of the argument was that, you know, we'd gain this sovereignty, right? But that's just an abstract, you know, that concept of freedom is an abstract thing. And, you know, legally, the UK or, you know, us might have less control, you know, ceding that with other people. But actually, day to day, you know, pragmatically, what we can and can't do, we have much more freedom when we did that. And that's definitely something that I kind of wasn't really... You know, I just saw it as, you know, there's an opportunity that can get to the next stage of its growth. And I've noticed this with other businesses that I've worked on as well. When you're scaling a business, you'll quite often hit a kind of a ceiling, and then sometimes, you know, that will happen again and again and again. And sometimes it will be obvious what that ceiling is or what's causing that and what you need to do to then break through it. And sometimes it won't. The deal that we did with Polychrome is very, very, very clear what that ceiling was. And it was very, very easy to go, right, well, you know, we just need to give half the business away to sensible, smart, well-intentioned people. And you know, luckily that's what happened. I mean, it might not have been sensible, smart, or well-intentioned, but I mean, you know, that's then you've got to check that they are before you do that. But yeah, like it was definitely it was definitely the single most important decision in the life of the company. And yeah, it's been really interesting watching that grow from that point. Yeah, because at the time I was the only one when we did that deal. I was the only one working on the project full time.
Oh, wow. So how long into the journey of the business did you go all just by yourself? Like, when did this deal happen in the history of the business?
So yes, the first commit was, I think, around 2017. And I started working on the project full time just before COVID. And then we did that deal. It was annoying because we couldn't meet each other. So we did the whole deal. One of them was in Cologne in Germany, and the other two guys were in America, on the West Coast at the time. And whatever we did, you know, none of us knew how tall we all were. So we concluded that like a little bit through, yeah, when you couldn't fly anywhere, basically, whenever that was in 2020. So again, like, I mean, that was several years, right? Like the business now in terms of like the code base is 6 or 7 years old. So it's been a lot of work that's you know, we just carried on. We haven't really, yeah, the growth curve has never, it's never hit that sort of like asymptotic thing, but it's definitely like, it's gone through different levels of gradient. And there's, you know, there's when we have new people onboarding onto the company, when we have an annual offsite, and you know, I show that graph, and it's kind of a mad graph because you can, you know, ask people at what point did Polychrome come on board, and that is, you know, painfully easy to point that out on the graph because of the effect it had on the business. Yeah,
Good choice. Then I think that's. That's a miraculous choice and a good one.
Yeah, I mean, we were very fortunate. It was very fortuitous to meet them because their model is extremely unusual. And I'd been having calls with VC firms for months, and I'd actually sort of given up, and I was like, there's no point doing these anymore because we were too small. You know, there was a lot of activity around B2B SaaS. Developer tooling as well was super hot. Like, the GitLab story and things like that, that was like super hot at the time. So I was getting inbound from VCs all day. I was taking calls from some of them the ones that I'd heard of, or the ones that sounded like they had an interesting take. But, you know, I was like, this is just isn't going to work for us. Like, it's not the right path for us. Yeah. So I don't quite understand why the VC industry is quite so homogenous in its approach. I mean, I guess I do because, you know, if they hit a couple of home runs, they get fantastically rich, but there's very, very little variety, in that space. And for us, like the perfect thing wasn't like, I think the worst thing that you could have done to us at the time was like, here's $4 million, spend it as quickly as you can. Right?
Do whatever you want, but you still don't know what to do and how to do it. But here's money. That is a problem. Yeah, I see this a lot too. It's like people all following the same rule book, the same playbook, yet nobody actually wants to do the work. Nobody wants to go into the business and actually shuffle things around for it to be better, or teach the founders how to do it right. I suffer from the same problem. Like, I'm not a salesperson, not a big marketer. I can do it kind of mostly, but I'm also completely out of my depth when it comes to enterprise sales. right? For that, I've just never done it. And I'm trying to learn it now with my business at this point, but it's a tough journey because if first off, not a first language English speaker, that's always a problem. Then I just don't know how to talk to people in that enterprise setting because I'm not from there. So there's a lot of different things that come and stack on top of each other to make this harder. So good for you to have found the right people at the right time. And what I find very interesting, because your journey is one of like absolute bootstrapping, yet you were open to these calls. You were open to talking to people about this and giving up 50% of your company to just improve it. That, I think, is such an interesting mindset in a world where everybody is black or white, either this, either that, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's. I mean, maybe it's just because it was COVID and I just wanted to have someone else to talk to. But yeah, I think the learning I've got is that, yeah, keep yourself open to things and then when the right opportunity comes along, then you have to grasp it really, really hard, right? And then we did make a bet on the business at that point. But I kind of also, I sort of foresaw, you know, there were, at that point before we did that deal, or, you know, like, right, there's two different branches here that the life of the business can take on. I obviously don't know what either of them look like. But the non-polychrome one did look like, to be honest, you know, because of my and the team's lack of experience around like building businesses like Flagsmith now is it kind of just sort of like pottering along, not really, you know what I mean? Like never really kind of like getting to that critical mass where it can bring on like, you know, have a reasonably sized team of in engineering and marketing and sales and stuff like that. And it just kind of would have, I think it just would have got pretty boring, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, a lot of business is doing the same thing every day, right? But if you're doing the same thing every day and nothing's really changing in terms of the you know, the revenue of the company, you know, who you're competing against, the sorts of clients you're talking to, then, you know, and then, On the other side of that branch was like, you know, the growth just sort of started to really come alive. We have money to bring in engineering, which meant that was more interesting because, you know, we weren't just sort of like firefighting customer issues and dealing with infrastructure problems, and we had people who could work on features in the platform and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you know, like you try and make a calculated risk on that, right?
Yes, it's that, and that's what it is. It feels like a founder choice to make at this point. Do you want to keep slugging along, or do you want to try something else? And I'm glad you made that choice. I think it's very inspiring to just see somebody give up something to then get something. I think that's quite noticeable.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, I think there's a bit of a perception that a lot of these deals are zero sum, and yeah, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's a slightly American mindset, and you know, like I was definitely of the opinion that yeah, this doesn't have to be a zero sum thing, and it's also, you know, I mean, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got given was like, you have to sell into a growing market, right? If you're selling into a contracting market, then, you know, or you know, if you're selling into something that's growing, then it by definition it's not zero sum for those entrants in that market, right? Those players in that market, and so yeah, like that was definitely you know, it's at the top of mind when we did that. But I think also, like, you know, you get the sort of the companies that have these almost like celebrity founders, right? Like in, you know, like the Hacker News folk, like there's, you know, there's probably 10 or 15 or 20, you know, founder CEOs that people, you know, in our world could name and, you know, kind of adulation towards, and they're kind of rock stars type thing. And I think, you know, like it's not just those people running those businesses, and there's definitely like, they become a little bit of a marketing thing themselves, right? And so that then filters down that if you're much smaller, you're like, oh, you know, like, but yeah, but this guy's doing it all by himself. You know what I mean? And that's obviously not the case, right? They've got like 8,000 people pushing behind them. And, you know, they might spend all of their days doing podcast recordings and photo opportunities and stuff like that. Right?
Just like you are right now.
I don't spend all my day doing kids.
No, but it's a valid way of doing some kind of brand adjacent marketing, like building a personal brand as a founder and then kind of letting that attention leak into the business as almost a lead generator, a funnel. That works too if you have the personality for it. If you can deal with people on the internet, right? That's another thing. Like if you can handle the trolls and stuff, and if you want to spend your time on that instead of doing technical work or doing customer outreach or all of this, it's always this kind of balance, a choice that you make at that point. But yeah, I think what you've done is just very consciously, very intentionally over many, many years, putting in the work. That is quite obvious with this. And that feels like that's the way to do it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no, you know, there have been situations in the industry. I remember when like Google AdWords launched, and there was like ad tech companies being launched and then like 9 months later being bought by Google for like $700 million or whatever. And there was loads of those, right? If you research that happened a lot. Those days, you know, yeah, those days are gone. Maybe there were those opportunities with crypto, but then that came with all the nonsense around it and stuff. So yeah, we've definitely been, the businesses that I've worked on have been in the concept that, yeah, you just, you know, you can't, I mean, we had the SaaS platform live for, you know, well over a year. And after a year, I think we had a few hundred pounds in MRR, which, you know, like was like, okay, you know, it's going to pay for a few beers after work and maybe some of the AWS cost.
Yeah, but that's where it starts, right? That's where it starts. Like you have a proven thing and then you make it better, 20 times better with the right people.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird as well because the number goes up so gradually, you know, and you don't really notice. And then so there's another business that I work on as a virtual office service called the Hoxton Mix in London. And we did Y Combinator, or we applied to Y Combinator, and we got an interview. We almost got in. We had two interviews, actually. And I always wonder what would have happened if we'd have got in. But anyway, we didn't. But I remember when we were at Y Combinator, we were at £18,000 MRR, which was quite, you know, it was a bit more of an established business. And that's always been interesting because that's been a marker of a number. Whenever I look at the MRR now, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's great. Because it was 20 grand when we went and met, you know, Sam Altman and blah, blah, blah. And actually, it's kind of annoying because, so Flagsmith has, I guess, the MRR that it had when we did the Polychrome deal. But the thing is, the number increases so gradually that it's often really hard. It's like something about the human brain that isn't able to stand back and go, wow, like that's a massive achievement. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
even if at the end of the year, like, you know, we do that to get together as a team and go, look, you know, we've had this year's gone from this to that and blah, blah, blah. And we've launched these things. And even if you literally sit down, write it out and then read it back to yourself, it's still very, very hard to just conceptualize that growth.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me, I don't know, but it's kind of annoying.
I think it's pretty common. I think it's another form of hedonic adaptation, kind of, right? You get used to it, like it's the hamster wheel of things, and it's like, okay, so that's 40,000, now it's 45,000. No, that's all right. I mean, that's still a quite significant improvement, right? It's like, what is it, 12.5%? Like it's a lot of change, yet the numbers are so big. I think that's our brain. The numbers are so big, even over 1,000 numbers are almost incomprehensibly huge. So it's just big and slightly bigger. It's all big. So I mean, it's a fun problem to have that your MRR is so high that even an increase in MRR is like, whatever.
I mean, it's not the size of it. It's just it's the kind of the linear growth as well. Like that's the thing. It's, you're kind of like, oh, you know, but yeah, like that's what I'm getting at. Like, you know, I mentioned it's never got that kind of asymptotic line, but the thing is, you know, if you spend 7 years doing something and it's growing at a linear rate or close to a linear rate, And you can do things to make that angle of that slope slightly different. You know, that time is a an immovable force in that function of that maths, right? Like that's, you know, and I think there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like that's the other great thing about not going down the VC route is we don't care. Like, you know, like we actually don't care. Because we've got there's no clock ticking in the background around anything to do with the business at all, right? And that's the thing that we avoided selling when we decided not to do that path. Yeah,
being able to compound at your own rate, like at your own accepted time, that's almost a gift to you as a business owner, right? Like that you can make your choices without feeling this anxiety-inducing pressure of some random arbitrary choice that was made 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, you've done your seed round right now. You need to grow X month over month to get to the next stage and then Y. And then, you know, like we've never had that ever. And, you know, so like I'm happy, you know, yeah, maybe the business could be bigger.
Man, you always can.
But I mean, I who cares? Like,
right? It probably makes it much more interesting to look at the future of the business, right? If that's not just growth numbers that you're looking at, you can also look at completely different things. What does the future hold for Flaxsmith? Where do you want to take it?
Yeah, so that's having a sustainable, like open source project. That's been super important to us as well, right? Like leaving a really well-engineered, usable, reliable platform that people can use for free has been like really, really important. And we've never been shy of saying, you know, we're going to make the SAML component closed source because that's how we make our money and that's how the business sustains itself. And that's how we have 5 engineers working on the product full time, you know, making the product better. So we've never been shy about doing that. It's also interesting as well because we've always wanted to have a very defined focus of what the product does. And there's always been a temptation to go like, oh, we could do analytics as well, or we could do like engineering analysis, and we could like look at, you know, I don't know, cycle time of flags and blah, blah, blah. Maybe we might do something in the very distant future around that. But we've never, you know, I don't know, like make it really good for like A/B testing. And so area of concern for what the problems the product should solve has always been quite rigid and quite narrow. And so we're kind of getting to the point where we're sort of there's features coming down the line around like being able to wrap a collection of changes together to form a release and doing stuff for larger teams. Like we just did a much more finely grained like permissioning system based on tags, so that multi team single projects with multiple teams aren't stepping on each other's toes and stuff like that. And that's another thing as well that I think you never hear, and maybe we should hear more often, is like, you know, maybe like the feature set is pretty much like we're kind of, you know, like that's kind of like, that's fine. There's a constant uphill battle dealing with framework changes, especially in the JavaScript ecosystem. PHP is very, very well behaved for that, I think, and Laravel is like, you know, making it secure, making it performant, having it, you know, all constantly improving the ergonomics of running it, installing it, upgrading it, all that sort of stuff. But in terms of like what it looks like when you log in 3 years, it's going to look the same, I think. I mean, like it might have a style refresh or something, but in terms of like what it's for and what you can do with the platform, it's probably not going to be different. Yeah.
That is so refreshing to hear. It is so refreshing to hear somebody say, hey, I like what we have and I think it's fine. We might do, you know, operational stuff, performance stuff. Obviously, that's just because there are so many externalities that you need to take care of, right? Integrations and whatever. But that's always out of your control. So you need to react to it. But proactively, we have what we need. And I love this tight scoping. And then you fill it with your product, and then your product is, for the lack of a better term, done. Or, you know, feature complete, like words we don't usually say in software engineering, but it's enough.
And we're lucky as well, because the concept of feature flags, just this dynamically controllable Boolean at its simplest, is so powerful in terms of, like, especially for larger teams, that, you know, it's almost like you're kind of, if you put too much, you know, like the dish is perfect, right? Like, and then if you just start adding a bunch of stuff, then you kind of like, what, you know, like you're almost kind of like encouraging bad engineering practices if you start putting fireworks and whiz bang features everywhere, because people have lost sight of like what it's there for in the first place as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like a very specific knife that a chef would use.
Right. Right?
Like it's not meant to be the knife for everything. It's a very specific professional expert level tool. And it should stay that, because I mean, that's almost the Unix philosophy of small tools, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Very much so.
I like that. Like, do one thing really well. And if you need to do another thing, build that other thing, but leave the first thing alone. I love that.
Yeah, that philosophy has definitely been a lot of what we've, you know, it's so easy to say yes to building a new feature, but it's so much harder and takes so much more control to say no, for sure.
Well, I love this. I love your approach to things. I love the choices you made along the way, the rationale behind them. It's really, really cool. And I love the whole journey. It's really nice to see something bootstrapping and then going the weird entrepreneurial path of doing whatever needs to be done. Right? It's just wonderful to watch. And I hope that your journey still has many decades to come. For anybody who wants to join you on the journey and wants to see like what you've been doing, what you've been working on, where should people go to follow you and see what you're working on?
Yeah, so github.com/flagsmith, that's the first place to go. We have a Discord server, which people can join and hack around. Like all of the stuff is findable from there. Flagsmith.com is the website. And then, yeah, the other one to shout out is Open Feature, which is openfeature.dev, and there's a CNCF Slack that has an open feature channel as well. There's definitely a ton of work. Like the open feature surface area of work is way, way larger than ours. And so I would, if people are interested in feature flagging, or if they've used it, and they want to get involved in a growing CNCF project, which is kind of cool. There's also, we'll be at the KubeCon in London in, I think it's either February or March, and there's an open feature, like morning, I think it is, where people can all get in a room and nerd out about like feature flagging and figure out what to work on. So yeah, they're the main places to check us out. Yeah.
That's exciting. And I love this. I love that you're shouting out this movement. That's really cool. Like that's really, really wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with me today. That was quite insightful. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Arvid.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Bootstrap Founder. You can find me on Twitter at Arvid Kahl, ArvidKHL. You find my books and my Twitter course there too. And if you want to support me and this show, please tell everybody you know about podscan.fm, leave a rating and a review. It makes a massive difference if you show up there, because then the podcast will show up in other people's feeds. Any of this will help the show. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye-bye.